everybody. We're back, and I'm Karen Hartglass. This is June 3rd, 2014, another It's All About Food program. Now let's get right to the next part with Mark Hawthorne, the author of Bleeding Hearts, The Hidden World of Animal Suffering. He's actually the author of two books. The other book is Striking at the Roots, A Practical Guide to Animal Activism. And we're going to jump right in and talk about Bleeding Hearts. Welcome to It's All About Food, Mark. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you, Karen. It's going to be challenging following somebody like Anthony.
No. I'm glad. I was so glad to hear to talk with him, and then I'm glad I set it up this way. I had no idea what it was going to be like, but I just finished reading your book, Bleeding Hearts, and I have to spell this B-L-E-A-T like Tom, I-N-G. I'm sure the pun is intended. But it's important, Bleeding Hearts, and I'm just emotionally exhausted after reading your book. And so when I was talking to Anthony, I was very inspired and glad to hear that there are safe spaces where people can be talking about this and then making change, because we need a lot of change. But first, we need to be educated, and that's what this book is all about.
Right, exactly.
How did you write it? I spent, you know, a brief time reading the 499 pages, but how do you write a book like this?
Very carefully. you know, after I had written Striking at the Roots, and it came out in 2007 and early 2008, I started getting emails from activists all over the world telling me about the various animal abuses that they were combating in their countries and how they were using Striking at the Roots to help them. And it really inspired me, and it showed me that not only is animal activism very much alive and well all over the world, but there are forms of animal exploitation that the mainstream media doesn't cover, or if it covers it, it's very minimal.
Yeah.
And so right after Striking at the Roots came out in 2008, I started working on Bleeding Hearts. I started gathering research and information and talking to activists and doing some traveling and just putting together what I see as the bigger picture of all these abuses that are happening. And then I just broke it down chapter by chapter and took breaks when I needed to, and I don't want to characterize the book as absolutely horrible. I mean, there are definitely atrocities in there that will trigger people, and I encourage people to just skip over those.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a vegan. I've been a vegan for a long time, and I think it's so important that all of us eat plants and get to that place one way or another, but when we know that we don't need to eat animals to survive, it opens a whole door. And if we weren't eating animals, I don't think any of these other things would be going on. But we accept all of this exploitation because we say we need to eat these animals, we say we need to wear these animals, and then we need to experiment on them, and we need to do all kinds of horrible things to them. And it's from reading in your book, it goes from bugs to giraffes and elephants, the big
and
the
whales.
Small.
Yeah.
Every animal, if someone can profit on it, they do something horrible.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I address the fact that 3,000 silkworms are killed to produce 1 pound of silk, and all the way up to the whale slaughter that happens in the Southern Ocean Sanctuary every year. We'll see if it happens in the next season. The Japanese have been ordered by the UN not to engage in that any longer, but you know, we'll see if they hold to that.
Well, the problem that I've had with the whole whale issue and the dolphin issue is that when people from the United States tell Japan what to do, we're being hypocrites because we do horrible things in this country with animals. So it's a difficult argument for us to point fingers and say you shouldn't be doing this because look at what we're doing over here.
It is. And I should point out that it was the International Court of Justice in Europe that handed down that ruling.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right. You know, we kill in this country 9-plus billion land animals a year for food, and we do all kinds of other atrocities, including you know, raising and killing animals for fur and using them for animal research and just many, many other abuses. So we really shouldn't be pointing fingers from a cultural standpoint. However, you know, the Southern Ocean is an international sanctuary for these animals. And what Japan is doing is, or has been doing, is considered illegal. So I don't think that it's incorrect of the United States or Australia or New Zealand or other countries to be saying, you know, Japan shouldn't be down there doing that and we need to do something about it. And as activists, we need to speak up.
Okay, let's just touch on a few different things in this book, and I really recommend people reading it. It's very dense. There's a lot of information in here, and it's just unbelievable. But let's just talk about a few things that are unbelievable. So people like their dogs and cats, and a lot of people have companion animals, and they say they're animal lovers, and they don't realize what's behind the pet food that they're giving their animals.
Right. Well, there's a couple things with pet food. One is that the major pet food companies actually test on animals, and they'll keep them in confinement, many of them for the rest of their lives, in cages, and they test the food. But beyond that, there's also something called 4D meat, which is meat that's been essentially not slated for human consumption because it's because of disease or some other reason. It's not considered clean for human use, and so they feed it to it gets rendered and it goes through a giant processing system where sometimes even flea collars go through that because these animals have been found, sometimes they're even companion animals, found on the road, and it's turned into like a slurry, and it ends up eventually finding its way as an ingredient into all kinds of animal feed, not just what we consider companion animal food, but also for the agriculture, for farmed animals.
It's recycling.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's cost effective.
It's completely legal, and it's done. It's been done for decades, and very few people know about it.
Well, we hear more about cows and pigs and chickens. Not enough, in my opinion, but we do talk about food animals, and there have been some undercover clips that have gotten out, and people are a little bit more aware of them. But there are so many animals out there. Oh, I mean, where do we begin? So the seals in Canada have been getting some press.
Yeah, the seal slaughter is going on right now in Canada. And, you know, the two major seal slaughters take place in Canada and in Africa, in Namibia. And the one in Canada going on right now is... it's really hubris, I think. I think the Canadian government is doing it because they don't want to be told, as we kind of touched on at the beginning of our conversation, they don't want to be told what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really very little market for it. You know, the EU has declared that there's a ban on seal products in Europe, and so Canada has been looking toward China and other countries to find a place for these products. And
now, it's just horrific what's done, but what is so profound to me is that these animals go to a place where they feel they can be safe to bear their children, and they're not safe at all. And and when are they going to learn that? And if they do learn it, where would they go?
Yeah, it's really tragic because, as you say, this is where these seals give birth. I mean, this is a nursery for these animals, and we're losing pieces of our environment constantly because of climate change, and unfortunately, the ice is one of those victims, and yeah, the seals are losing habitat constantly, and it's just such a tragedy to see these things. And that actually, one of the things I talk about in my activism is how activists need to protect themselves from certain images if it triggers them. And when I first got involved in activism, it was the images of the sealers on the ice beating to death these seals that triggered for me just the most horrible mm-hmm. nightmares and thoughts. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that I have to keep my distance from. And when I was writing that section, of course, I had to really step back and be careful about how I was characterizing it, how I was describing it, because I want it to be accurate, but I also don't want people to be so put off by it that they don't take it in and want to do something about it.
There's a lot of detail in this book. You talk about the skinning of different animals and how many of them are still alive when it happens, dogs even.
Yeah.
It's just, and I know this. I've read these things before, but I think it's important to read them again from time to time. It's just unbelievable. And personally, I like to focus on the joy behind plant food eating and all the delicious recipes and how good we look and how good we feel. I'm not sure if I'm just trying to protect myself from staying away from the reality, but it's good to check in every now and then and remind ourselves of how awful it really is.
It is awful, and I wanted to be careful when I wrote the book to include information on what people can do about it.
Right.
And so throughout the chapter, you find stories of activists and groups working to make change. And you also have each chapter ending with long sections about people you can contact, groups you can get involved with, ways you can personally help. So I want this to empower people like Striking at the Roots does. I want people to feel that they can have a voice, that they can make a change, that they can be agents of change, and not just feel helpless after reading the book.
One of the stories that I liked was about the woman who saw the bile bears.
Oh, right, Jill Robinson.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to look in the eyes of another being, whether it's a human animal or a non-human animal.
Yeah.
There's a connection. Can you just briefly tell that story?
Sure. Well, Jill Robinson was in Asia. She's actually from England, and she was living in China, and she was an animal advocate, but she heard about the whole bear bile industry, and she decided to take a tour of one of these farms, and she kind of got away from the group at one point and went downstairs under one of these buildings, and she found just cage after cage of these moon bears, Asiatic black bears they're also called, in these just horrible conditions. In some cases, the flesh was growing into the bars because they had been in there so long. And each one of them had a tube into his or her abdomen, and it was basically milking their bile. And the bile is used in traditional Chinese medicine as a curative. And it comes from the gallbladder. And she heard this sound in the darkness, and she got closer and closer, and she realized that one of these bears was suffering. They all were suffering, but this is one who was sort of communicating, vocalizing to her. And Jill put out her hand, and she said this bear grasped, you know, she felt this big paw around her hand, and she realized later that was probably not the smartest thing to do, because this bear had no idea who she was, and she could have been one of the people torturing her.
It knew. He knew. That bear knew.
And it just completely transformed Jill, and she dedicated her life to helping these bears, and she founded Animals Asia, and they do incredible work. They have two sanctuaries. They have one in China and they have one in Vietnam. And they just recently rescued 200 bears from one of these bear bile farms. The bear bile farm in China agreed to close, and they're turning that into another sanctuary for bears. And it's absolutely astounding, and it's stories like that that give me hope.
Yep.
And it's stories like that that I wanted to include in the book to share this information. And I was very, very thrilled that Jill participated and was willing to talk to me about her work.
We were talking earlier in the program with Anthony Nocella about his work and how he has spaces where people can come together and talk about animal studies and things related to animals in a safe, secure environment. Mm-hmm. And he just briefly mentioned, and I thought, oh, I want to talk about this later, but how in schools students have to do dissections and things if they're in some sort of medical or biological field. And you talked a bit about that, about how some students didn't want to do it and how many of them were made to do it. Their grades were threatened, their performance in school was threatened, and it just took the courage of one in particular to make change. And I think there's been a lot of schools that have changed over time, but it takes a lot of courage to make change and speak out.
Right. Yeah. One story that comes to mind from the book is Jennifer Graham, who was a high school student in California, and she didn't want to dissect frogs, and she actually brought a lawsuit against the school board and won. And now it's thanks to Jennifer and brave students like her that high school students don't have to dissect animals in school. They can opt out. And that goes, you know, it becomes more difficult as you get into college and certainly as you get into medical school. But there are changes being made. There are groups like, you know, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine that are offering alternatives, that are working toward change, that are making it so schools have humane options, whether they're 3D models or some sort of advanced technology that don't involve animals, to just offering students ways that they can learn the information without having to conflict with their own morals, you know, to contradict their values.
I guess one of the things that just kept hitting me in this book is it just seemed like so many products, almost every product has some cruelty involved in it. So you mentioned the process of making a pearl, something small and lovely and yet horrible.
Yeah, they inject a little irritant into the oyster so that the mm-hmm. animal, you know, puts a coating over this irritant eventually, and it becomes a pearl, and then they kill the animal and extract the pearl. And yeah, it's just,
yes,
astounding. It's just for this little thing that you'll wear, which we have so many humane alternatives. There's things that are just as beautiful as a pearl that don't involve cruelty, at least not cruelty to humans and animals. And there's just no reason for it.
And then another point, you were talking about leather, and I know how many times I've heard some people will eat a vegan diet, but they wear leather because they feel the cows are being killed for food anyway, the leather's a byproduct, and you know, they'll use it. And, you know, everybody's got to make a choice what's right for them. But the leather industry, you explained, supports the food industry. They both make significant profit, and one can't do without the other.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they're really co-products. Leather is not a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
They're co-products. They go hand in hand. I don't remember off the top of my head the figure, but it's something like $40 billion U.S. dollars a year in sales just from leather. And, you know, it's, as you say, people think that, oh, you kill a cow for her flesh and then you take the skin, so it's not wasted. But, you know, there's really so many little products like calf skin and, you know, that are specialty products that are obviously not byproducts. They couldn't be byproducts. They're part and parcel to the whole business of exploiting animals. They're considered resources, and they're harvested. And it seems like our goal is to squeeze the last penny out of an animal, and that's become standard practice.
Well, as I was reading, I kept thinking, thinking I didn't want to be a part of the human race.
Oh no. Karen, I don't want you to feel that way.
No. But then I step back and, you know, you start to see all the beauty and the hope. But it's just unfathomable what we're capable of. And yet I do believe in my core that every person is capable of transformation.
Absolutely. I wasn't born vegan. It took me, unfortunately, 30 years before I recognized what I was doing and decided that I didn't need to eat animals and that I didn't need to wear them. I didn't need to exploit them in the way that I was really
what,
a
what
part
was it,
of.
What was the epiphany for you? What was the veil lifting for you?
Well, I had a couple of events that occurred within a couple months of each other. I was living in Europe at the time. This was in the 90s, and I decided I wanted to go to Pamplona and run with the bulls. And so I went to I was living in Germany. I took the train down to Pamplona, and I did the whole bull run. I thought it was, you know, this great Hemingway experience. And then at the end of the bull run, all the bulls go into the bull ring, and then all the tourists and the bull runners go in and sit on the stands. And hundreds and hundreds of people are in the bull ring taunting these steers. They're not the actual bulls who will fight, but they're these other animals that have smaller horns. And they're hitting them with newspapers, and they're just becoming, they're just ridiculing them. I don't know how else to describe it. And I just felt so ashamed to be part of this event. And a couple months later, I was living in India, and I was living with a Buddhist family in the Himalayas, and the only time that they would consume animals was when they would drink tea. They would drink what's called butter tea.
Hmm.
And it's this horrible salty thing that made me cry. And the only way I could even swallow it was if I thought of it as soup and not tea.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of cows who lived across the street, across the road, I should say. And the other part of the story is that the family I lived with had this big garden. And I would say 99% of what I ate came from their garden. And as it got toward winter, they dug a big hole in the ground, and they harvested the crops, and they buried it. For the winter, they buried the vegetables and fruits.
Hmm.
And then they let one of the cows in from across the road to sort of nibble on the stems and the remaining crops. And I had never been so close to a cow in my life, notwithstanding my experience in Pamplona. And I was maybe 4 or 5 feet from this beautiful cow, and she just was looking at me, and I was looking at her, and I realized she has absolutely every right that I do in terms of living and enjoying her life. There's no reason I need to eat.
You looked in her eyes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just recognized the beauty in her and her will to live and enjoy her life and not be abused by humans. And so that's when I decided. I had been living essentially a vegan life for 2 months already, and I felt physically and spiritually fantastic. And I thought, there's just no reason for me to continue this way. And so I stopped eating animals.
Well, Mark, I'm glad you had that experience, and I'm grateful for this book that you wrote, and everyone should read it. We need to know about all of this and then be inspired to do a lot about it, because there's a lot of work to be done.
Thank you. Can I mention my website?
Yes, yes, of course.
People can just go to markhawthorne.com, and they'll learn more about it. And I really appreciate being on your show, Karen.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Wow. Mark Hawthorne, Bleeding Hearts, The Hidden World of Animal Suffering. Thank you for listening, and read that book, okay? I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is another It's All About Food. Go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and watch that Lone Vegan trailer, please. Thank you, and have a delicious week.